Good afternoon, colleagues, and welcome to those of you in the audience. I see our first subject today is on the Oregon report card, and I think all of us have had report cards at one time or another. If we're looking nervous or anything, you might understand, maybe understand why. But anyway, we look forward to hearing about the Oregon report card. We know it came out on the 30th yesterday, and so there's been a lot of attention focused on it. So with that, we'll invite you up, and we'll be anxious to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Schneider, and I'm the director for the school and district report card. And with me today are Catherine Heaton, who is the education specialist for the report card. And we've also are lucky to have Bev Johnson, who is the principal of Salem Heights Elementary School, and just coincidentally received an exceptional rating on a report card.
So it's a good day for you to be out and about there.
Yeah. So what I would like to do for you today is to just give you an overview of what happened yesterday and how it went, and walk you through the lists of that you have in front of you, and show you an example of the data that led up to being an exceptional school. And then Bev can talk about what kinds of things she purposely did to take her school from point A to point B. If that will work for you, I'll go ahead. Yesterday we did release the fourth school and district report card. We released 1,084 school report cards and 198 district report cards. It went quite smoothly, and as you can see from your handouts, the blue news release shows the number of exceptional schools at 91, the strong schools at 399, the satisfactory at 557, and the low at 28, and the unacceptable at 7. And although the standards did change in 2003, we know that one of the first questions people asked is, how does this differ from last year? So we just provided those numbers for you. The ivory sheet that's next breaks those numbers out by rank, but also by level. So you see the total, all schools by rating. For example, exceptional is 91, but you can look below and see that of those 91, 85 were elementary or middle, and 6 were exceptional high schools. And I do have a list of exceptional high schools in here for you too. The next piece is an illustration of how the first 3 years of the report card were the same basic formula, and this last release yesterday is the beginning of the next round. So if you would want to make some comparisons, it would be appropriate to compare the last 3 years and then look for next year to compare this year. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then there's a list of the schools that were rated low and unacceptable, and followed by the schools that were rated exceptional. And I have them by district and name the school. And that's front and back. And then the following sheet is a list of the 6 exceptional high schools. And then the next sheet that you see is student performance data, and with Bev's permission, she said it was okay if we shared this. This is data that we make available for each school in the state, and every student that took the test is accounted for. So what you see is the data from 1998-99, 99-2000, 2000-2001, and then 2001-2002. So you can look at the number of students that are in the very low category, in the low category, the nearly meets, and exceeds. And although they're not the same kids, it does give you an opportunity to look and see as a whole where the students are in terms of that, those areas. That the math knowledge and skills, which is the multiple choice, and the reading knowledge and skills, which is the reading multiple choice. And those are the main pieces of the student performance rating. And I think some of the most important information is on that graph that is the student performance trends. And again, this is Bev's school, and it shows the progress that she's made over time in the area of math and the area of reading. It also shows the attendance trends. And the scale on the left, you see the top is 90%. Those are adjusted to the data, so that the next piece that I'm going to show you is the top of that graph is 45. So look at the next page that doesn't have a school's name on the top, because that would be this the last page. This is an example of a school that received an unacceptable rating. And although this school did make progress in, and I'm looking at the performance trend graph, although this school made progress in both math knowledge and skills and in writing, you can see that graph went up, their other performances went down, and their students are still performing at a relatively low level, and their dropout trend was increased. The student dropout rate was increased from 9.5 to 10.3%. So these are the basic components that go into the ratings, and if you would like to move from to move back to the graph that is from Salem Heights Elementary School, which has its name on the top, then I think Bev Johnson might have some specifics about what happens at a school when you get this kind of information.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm the principal at Salem Heights Elementary School. We have 300 students approximately that are preschool through fifth grade. And about 5 years ago, we looked at our data and our demographics and the needs of our school, and we determined that we were doing okay. And we've been doing okay for quite a while, but we wanted to go farther with our student performance. We are a Title I school, and it was actually in the year 98-99 that we first received Title I funds, so we were able to have some flexibility and make some decisions that allowed us to go further in the area of school improvements. We have about 30% of our students are English language learners. 50 of those are deaf and hard of hearing students, and we have three ERCs that have students with numerous disabilities, including being deaf and hard of hearing. So we are a unique school. We are the regional Services Area 4, Willamette ESD's deaf and hard of hearing students with preschool through fifth grade. So about 5 years ago, we identified that our students were not performing where we wanted them to be. We compared our results with the results of schools that were in a similar socioeconomic grouping around the state, found out from them what they were using as materials, what teaching strategies they were using, and also compared what we were doing, what they were doing to this and how it aligns with the state standards. We found out that we had some holes. We then researched...
Excuse me. Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt. Did you use a database initiative to compare?
Yes, we did.
Good. Good. We've heard a lot about
the
database.
We are absolutely data-driven.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, we did. Good question. As we... as I said, we do have a large group of students who are deaf and hard of hearing or English as a second language. So we wanted to make sure that we were meeting their needs specifically as we were looking at improvement. So in the area of math, we chose a program that other, I shouldn't say program, a strategy that some other districts were schools were using with the effectiveness, and it's hands-on, real visual approach to math. We had intensive staff training because it was a totally different approach to math than we had been using. It's 30 hours of training that we had during that first school year. We began a math facts incentive program. We call it Math Masters, and everyone at the end of the year that knows their math facts for that grade level gets to keep the party with me, and that's kind of a fun thing. Mm-hmm. We identified 60 minutes of uninterrupted time during the school day, every single day, where we do have focused math instruction. Our upper grades, then, we went to ability grouping that's a flexible ability grouping for math for those students. And at that time, we were blessed to have smaller class size, and that did help us out. We also began having a school-wide benchmark scoring for math every 6 weeks. And so we gather that data, we compare it, teachers across grade levels compare, and use that to modify their instruction. And then 2 years after that, we began focusing on reading. We did a real similar process as far as look at our scores and data, look at other districts and schools with similar demographics, and we selected a program or strategies, actually, that had a variety of venues as far as ways to teach kids. Just the phonics approach will not work with deaf and hard hearing students. So we have a balanced literacy approach. We had 26 hours of intensive instruction for our teachers that everyone bought into and is involved in. And we also were able to add some intervention programs that following year after we used all them. The first couple of years, we needed to use our money from Title I to focus on staff development. Once we had those pieces in place and we were able to buy the materials that supported the instruction with those strategies, we then were able to use some of our money for a intervention program, and we have a teacher that works with early intervention for reading with those struggling readers. We also at that time had a reading recovery program. We had that for 2 years, and although that would not show on that data that we have here, it just coincidentally is the same time that the school started seeing improvement all across the grades in reading. We identified a 90-minute block of time that's uninterrupted in literacy. And, again, we don't have assemblies and those kinds of things during that time. And at that time, we were still blessed with having smaller class sizes.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, yes, Representative Dalton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. May I just pause you for a moment? I just wanted to inquire about your reading recovery program and what happened to the kids in your school when you had to phase that out of the Salem-Keizer School District phased the program out.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, that was cut from our budget for this year, so this is the first year we do not have reading recovery.
follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up?
Yeah, my question was, what happened to the kids in the reading and recovery program in your school?
Oh, as far as their performance?
Well, they were being served by the reading specialists, and now they're presumably being placed into other programs
to
work on with reading.
They're in our classroom, in our mainstream classrooms. They already were, but they are not pulled out for a reading intervention. Many of those students actually became on grade level readers, and so they don't need intervention strategies. Some of them still are struggling readers, and we were able to use Title I funds this year to add to our intervention program, and so we do have a Title I reading teacher who works with the intermediate students who are still struggling readers.
May I?
Please follow up.
So it sounds like you had you added an additional staff member to sort of work with the kids that continued to need help.
There were a couple of things that happened at the same time. One was our primary literacy program was eliminated from our school. And so we were able to get a federal reading teacher for halftime. So that person continued with the younger children with an early intervention model for reading, which is similar to the strategies used in reading recovery. It's called the Arkansas model. So she's using those strategies with the younger readers. And then we were able to use our Title I funds to pay for her other half, which is focused on reading strategies for third through fifth graders.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
This year, our money, as I've said, is pretty much tied up into staffing. Because we've been focused and used our funds towards the staff development, we now are able to continue staff development on our own in-house. Teachers training each other in what strategies are working best for them. And they said we no longer have the primary literacy, but we do have a federal reading teacher half day. We have the Title I teacher half day, and they do the work with the intervention with our young children. And our class sizes are much larger than they were, and we're seeing an impact with that quite a bit as far as teachers spending more time with classroom management and less time with intervention with one-on-one with students.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
If I may, with an aside right now, the group of students that just walked into the room are a group of high school students from Lane County, all from Eugene, I believe. From South Eugene, Churchill, North Eugene, no Churchill, but South Sheldon and North. Okay. And they're beginning a program where they're going to be bringing, hopefully, large numbers of high school students to the Capitol to see how our government operates. Okay. Welcome.
Those of you from Sheldon High School have been singled out already for your exceptional report cards.
Did you know that?
So your timing is impeccable as far as to show up in front of the House Education Committee. Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of guests I'd like to introduce too, Nathan Riley and Michael Moynihan, who are from the Town Point Job Corps Center. And they've been job shadowing me today, but unfortunately I have been nothing more than a shadow for most of the time, but I am glad that they're here to visit. They have to go home tonight, and if you've been watching the news, the weather and the roads are not cooperating greatly, so enjoy your visit.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, that ends our formal presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions that we can. And we wanted to try to complete the loop from using data to reporting public accountability to show the effect that happens in the actual schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a quick question. How are parents receiving the report card in general? Are they supportive of it? Are they looking forward each year to receiving the results of their school and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, our parents are delighted when we have high scores. Last year was strong, and they were ecstatic. This year, when I announced to the student body and teachers that we were exceptional, you could hear it was like the end of a football game or something. We were all cheering at the end. So we do take it seriously. We put a lot of emphasis on it, but we also realize it's a picture of a particular time, and it's not everything.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Do you find that parents, when you have excellent results to report, maybe get more excited about participating, and maybe your participation rates from parents and volunteerism and that sort of thing increases? Do people get excited and have sort of a pride in their school?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalton, we have a high participation of volunteers, and some of them are actually community members, retired citizens who volunteer in our reading tutoring program, and they have a sense of pride, and they share in the feeling of success. But I don't know that it changes the participation. They do get. Of course, I have available, and when visitors come, our report card is by chance, and they're, you know, that's a nice thing to be able to share with them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Avakian.
Thank you, and congratulations, by the way, on great results. In addition to the standardized scores that allow, the reflection on the math and the writing and such, how do you highlight or check the progress of your music and arts and physical education programs in your school, how do you present, I guess, the value of continuing those programs with your parents and teachers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Avakian, we have what we call a comprehensive school improvement plan, and it covers all areas of the curriculum, including the arts and physical education, and there are tests that are given on a yearly basis to particular age groups of students, and those are compared from year to year.
Mr. Chair?
Follow-up?
These are tests that your school in particular does?
Our district does, and we do that across the district.
Oh. Thank you.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nancy, I'd like for you to focus in and help me understand, first of all, the composition of the overall grade, and secondly, its validity, not from a statistical point of view, but from a usefulness point of view.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I think that's a very good question. The overall rating is made up primarily of the student test scores, but it has a component of their dropout and their attendance rate if they're a high school. If they're a middle or an elementary, it's just the attendance. And then they also get improvement points if they've improved, which could bump them up into the next rating. So it's about 80% student test scores and about 20% attendance and dropout. And then the improvement part, if they've improved, that could bump them up, say, from low to satisfactory or satisfactory to strong. Does that make sense?
Follow up. If I'm understanding you correctly, then a school that had higher achievement scores could score lower on the overall grade than a corresponding school that did score higher. In other words, did I word that backwards? You could have a higher scoring school on achievement receive a lower rating than a school that received lower on the achievement part, because the one would get bumped up.
Yes, that is possible.
Okay. Is that problematic at all?
Yes, it can. It depends on which end you're on.
Right. You're a bump upper or a bump downer.
Yeah. What we were hoping, and what we have been able to do when we've had a chance to explain that, is to show that the student performance does stand more alone, and that when you look at the trends and look at the picture as a whole, sometimes it makes more sense. When you look at just the test scores, we know that just test scores are not anywhere near a total picture of a school, so that attendance part and that dropout part has to work along with it. And sometimes just a little bit of a decline, say, in your attendance, or a little bit of an increase in your dropout rate, can affect that overall rating. Does that make sense?
Yeah, another poll.
Yes, follow up.
It does make sense. I guess I just question exactly what you're saying, or the outcome of what you're saying. Isolating out the achievement part is certainly critical. And I guess hypothetically, I would say if you had a school district that had very, very, very low attendance, and yet they were very high scorers on everything, I'm not sure that gives you accurate information about the quality of the school, because if the education is happening, I started to say, who cares if the kids are there, but that is kind of a ridiculous statement. But I think you see my point.
Representative Hobbs, we have had that discussion. That's a very good question. If, for example, a school has 100% of its kids exceeding the standard, but their attendance is low, does it matter? And at this point, since the legislation requires the overall rating to be a compilation of test scores and school characteristics and student behavior, we have to put those all together into the overall rating. But the one improvement this year that we've gotten really great feedback on is the part that breaks out the student performance. So yes, you can say, yes, this school has exceptional student performance. And so that's very clear.
I have kind of it's a subjective question, and it may have come up, it may not have, but let's focus, say, on some schools that did very poorly. I'm sure there's been a lot of discussion about that, but what would you say would be the school attitude about the teachers in such a school, or even the students or the parents of the students? Their school was regarded very poorly as far as on the test of the report card. Do you have any experience with that, or could you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, we called Catherine and I called the superintendents and principals of all the low and unacceptable schools. It's devastating for a school to have to be working as hard as they can every day, and regardless of whether they're showing results. I use the example of rowing in a rowboat. Everybody's rowing as hard as they can row. School improvement just means you're all rowing in the same direction. But regardless, everybody's working as hard as they can, and to be told that your school is low or unacceptable is a hard, hard thing to swallow. Many of the schools already expected that. They analyzed their data. They knew what was coming. And they were involved in school improvement efforts. And remember, this is last year's data. So some schools are right on the right path. Other schools were surprised because they had made quite good gains in 1 year, but the year before they were fairly low, or they had dropped. So because it's a two-year average, they were still carrying that baggage. So in answer to your question, it's a very, very hard thing. It's not viewed as, oh boy, mm-hmm. This is going to help us now. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I notice in the high schools that received unacceptable ratings, 4 out of the 7 are alternative schools. With the database that we're gradually ramping up, is there a possibility of disaggregating the data so that we can look at some other characteristics that might be influencing these scores or these readings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, we had a study underway that did do exactly that. We were looking at a way to show alternative schools' strengths, because this system does not highlight their strengths. In other words, you could have students that come into the system that come in at a fourth grade level, and in a year they could arrive at an eighth grade level, make 4 years growth. It wouldn't show up because they're tested at a tenth grade level. And to say that that is that they're not achieving is not correct. So the study was an individual student growth model where we were looking at credits, we were looking at a variety of things that were important to the alternative schools. Because of some budget cuts and some districts weren't able to come up with the money that it would cost to test all the kids in the same way at the same time, we had to put that on hold. But it's still a very worthy project, I think, and I'd like to be able to try to pick that back up.
Follow up.
It seems like there would be some importance to disaggregating. We always hypothesize about the impact of socioeconomic status, and we do include that in our funding formula to a limited extent with the poverty part. So I think that would be important data to have, particularly when we're going with No Child Left Behind, and we theoretically could have kids hopping from one school to another here, which is a bit scary. So I commend you and hope that that can be facilitated.
I have one last question. If you had your druthers, what changes would you make in the school report card? It's kind of an essay question, I know. It's not a multiple choice one, though.
Which hat do I get to wear to answer this question, Mr. Chair?
One that gives us good answers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All of them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to give two answers to that, and then we'll see what my colleagues here would like to say. As a school person, and I was an elementary principal for 20 years, my experience has been that sort of like Bev's, when you get good information back from a larger organization, be it the state, be it the national, whatever it is, it's always good news. If it's not good news, parents are the first to say, this isn't representative of my school. So I think parents really are more involved now than they've ever been, and they are making good judgments in the school. So on the one hand, I'd like to say we should allow parents more say in what they think of their school, because they're the ones that are bringing their kids there every day. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot of merit to looking at things from the same standpoint for every school and say that we know one size doesn't fit all, but this information does give us the kind of data that Bev can pull up and say, hey, I want to look at some other Title I schools and get that information. If we didn't have something like this, we wouldn't have that opportunity. So changes that I would make would be, I would like to have some way of comparing which districts really do have a strong arts program that needs to be publicly credited so that it can stay, so that if a school wanted to compare another, wanted to say, I want a strong arts program, and I see this school has it, how can I find that? But I'm not sure that would be an easy thing to do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair and Representative Committee, I too have two ways of looking at it. Being at a school last year that was rated strong, and the difference between the dot on the line that separated our school from the neighboring school that was exceptional. This year it's reverse. It was hard to take when people would come to when shopping for schools and decide to go to the neighboring school because the score, the rating was higher than another school. Our program was not weaker then than it is this year. And I doubt that the neighboring school has a lower performance this or pro, you know, functioning program this year than they did last year. I would like to see that there are either all they're either exceptional or good or high performing schools, and there's those that need improvement. That little tiny difference between strong and exceptional, I don't know why we need to do that. The data this year with only using objective tests, I support. It's difficult to be in a school and having subjective tests such as the way someone scores a writing paper or the way someone scores a open-ending math assignment is so critical for our school rating. I hope we can continue the way we are. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I do believe that the benchmark assessments are important. And I do believe that they need to be used for instruction. And I do believe they need to be used on a regular basis. And I would encourage that to be part of the report card. How many students were given the opportunity to pass the benchmark at the state level, but in their school, and also how many passed, met, exceeded, whatever. I think that would be more helpful information, and it would be designed towards more of an instructional level.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. More helpful information than what? Than the comparison between the schools?
No, than the comparison. Excuse me, I didn't do that correctly. Than just looking at the objective tests that are given once a year.
The objective meaning multiple choice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I also think that many states just give a report to parents. They put the data on the report, but they don't put a judgment on the data. They'll give the information that Bev was talking about, or they will say, this is the data in the school, and that is their report card. That has some advantages because you can look for what you want to look for, whatever's important to you. And in that kind of data, we could include band and orchestra information, how many students are in this, that, and the other thing, as schools would report it. For our particular card with the particular legislation, it does require a simpler version which says you will call a school exceptional or strong, which is clearer to parents, I think, but it's a different look. It requires the judgment to be put on the data. That has advantages and disadvantages.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your coming in and hearing from you. So that's excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next major topic is charter schools, Oregon's version of charter schools, and we have a presentation by Jim Green. And Jim, will Joni be coming up with you? Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Pleasure to be before you this session. I think it's the first time I've been before you this session. I've been spending a little time down in the House PERS Committee of late. They seem to be taking an extraordinary amount of my time. And with me today is Joni Gillis. What you have in front of you, hopefully, and our handouts on the back page, is a presentation that Joni and I have kind of done around the state with school districts when an application shows up in front of them, or the school district in and of itself is thinking about starting a charter school. And there's approximately 22 pages of information there. We'll walk you through, not every page, but hit the highlights there. And then also a document that we prepared shortly after the 99 session when the charter school law became law in Oregon that we prepared for our school boards around the state. And that's where I'd like to start the presentation with. Very quickly, just a kind of a charter school 101 on the law, what it means, and then we'll give you an update on what's gone on across the state. As I said, the bill became effective after the 99 session, and we currently have 23 charter schools in the state with many, many more applicants coming along, and Joni can get into that in a moment. But essentially, what charter schools are in Oregon, which is a little bit different than the other 39 states that have them, they're public schools within the district in which they're sited. Whether that school district is the sponsor or the state board may sponsor it. In our law, we have two ultimate sponsors, either the local school district or the state board of education. One of the documents that's in your handout, and I believe it's page 2, is the flowchart that shows what happens when an application comes before a school district. And there are very tight timelines that were put in the statute for school districts to act. The Department of Education, working with the Oregon Charter School Service Center and OSBA and COSA, also put in an administrative rule so that when an application came in that wasn't complete, because if you'll look at this document on your free time, this explains all the things that need to be in the application. It also explains which laws apply and some funding things. But originally, we saw some applications that came in that didn't contain everything that was supposed to be in an application. And for those of you that were around back in 1999, you'll remember we created a process that's very rigorous. This is not something that you can draw up within an hour, submit it to a school district, and be running a charter school within 60 days. This takes a lot of thought and time and planning, and that was done purposely by the legislature. You wanted to make sure that kids were going to be learning in these environments and that they were going to be successful. So the Department of Ed set up a process where they've given the school district 15 business days from the date they received the application to let the applicant know whether it's complete and what they would need to get a complete application to them. And what we've tried to foster in the state, and I think it's worked quite well because of the relationship that we have with Rob Kramer at the Oregon Charter School Service Center and John Wiljegren and the Department of Ed, we've tried to foster a cooperative agreement between districts and charter school applicants. Now, has it always worked that way? No, it hasn't always worked that way. We've had some districts that have denied charter schools for what would be considered all the right reasons. We've also had one that was just recently sponsored by the State Board of Education, you may have read about in the paper. So we had a district that, according to the State Board, denied one for all the wrong reasons. So it hasn't always been amicable, but we've tried to create an air of cooperation and work with our boards. This is pretty tough because if you read in the Statesman Journal, at least according to the Salem-Keizer School District, which for some unknown reason has seemed to get the most applications in the state, also has the most charter schools in the state, it takes an inordinate amount of staff time. We've formed a service center at the School Boards Association to help school districts with that. You're looking at the sole employee of that service center, so I've been traveling around the state quite a bit. Joni and I think we've logged probably 3,000 or 4,000 miles together doing presentations to both charter school applicants and charter schools. We believe that these schools should be successful and also provide a good educational program for boys and girls. You can look through the material there on how the process flows, and it's not easy. I mean, there's public hearings. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes, not only for the school district, but the applicant. And it is a very rigorous process for both sides, because one of the things that's required in the law, and we'll get into in a moment, is that a school district must do a good faith evaluation. That's very key in this law because that ultimately could protect the district in some sort of liability should something go wrong at the charter school. They are protected under the law only if they do the good faith evaluation. So they really need to take the time and make sure that good things are going to happen for kids, as well as there's a lot of time on the part of applicants that are putting together these proposals. If Joni and I would have brought all the material we bring, We generally bring an application from one of the charter schools that was literally 300 pages in length. In response to that, the district had additional questions, and that charter school applicant put together another 120 pages of information. That school is up and running. It's one of the most successful charter schools in the state. Their students, at least last year, I didn't get a chance to look at the report card this year, scored exceptionally well on the statewide test. It's very successful. It's up in the Westland-Wilsonville School District. It takes an inordinate amount of time, and also for the district, once they approve one and go to negotiate that charter, that contract, I've seen them be 4 pages, which really probably isn't adequate enough for a charter, to a 49-page one that I just recently negotiated for a school district and covers everything from soup to nuts with regard to a charter school. May have been a little bit overkill, but that's probably what happens when you get two lawyers involved on the side there. I think Joni'd like to walk you through the statewide context, and we'll go ahead and walk through the presentation, and then happy to answer questions as we go.
Okay. I'm Joni Gillis from the Department of Education, and I'm pleased to be able to report on the statewide context of charter schools. First of all, I'd like to reiterate what Jim has said. Charter schools sometimes can be contentious, and they certainly can be a lightning rod. But Oregon purposefully, in 1999, decided that collaboration and cooperation would be in the best interest of the kids, and that's what really charter schools are all about. So we really set out to work closely with, well, ODE, and working very closely with Oregon School Board Association, and working very closely with the Oregon Charter School Service Center, Rob Kramer and John Liljegren. So not that, you know, we've always agreed on everything, but it's been a real partnership and a real effort at collaboration. So I just wanted to mention that. To date, we have 23 charter schools, public charter schools, in an operation throughout the state, educating about 2,500 students. The next 2 pages after the statewide context is kind of a sampling of the special focus of the different charter schools. So you can kind of get an idea that one of the goals of Senate Bill 100 or ORS 338 was creative, flexible, innovative teaching methods and different opportunities. So you can kind of get an idea that with the list of the different focus, they're, you know, that's truly happening. I'd like to focus just on three very quickly. Armadillo Tech is out of Phoenix Talent Charter School. It was one of our first charter schools, and they serve, they're in their third year of operation. They're an at-risk school, and they have they have a component of technology and a very strong community service program. Then we have up in the East Counties, we have a very unique proposal. Actually, they have been chartered. It's the Center for Advanced Learning, and that's Gresham Barlow, Centennial, Reynolds, Corbett, and the Community College, Mountain Hood Community College, joined together.
Excuse me, yes, Representative Farber.
Regarding the Center for Advanced Learning, and I guess other schools in general, are there any admission requirements? Are there any tests that require children to pass, that are required children to pass in order to get into any other schools?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, no, there cannot be any requirements. The statute says that there are two requirements, and that's age and grade, or that can be the only conditions. I believe that might have been not accurately reported just recently. It said that they had to have some kind of, I don't know if it was a GPA or some kind of interest, but no, it is an open, it is open to any student within the district. Now, this one is going to be very unique because it's 4 or 5 districts coming together, so the number of students might change, but there cannot be. Now, they can have a special focus, and they can say, for example, if it's an arts and or performing arts, they can say, this is our curriculum, and we're not going to have basketball. We're going to dance, and we're going to paint. So if you are really interested in something else, then this might not be the best fit. But if a student or a parent really wants to choose that school, then there cannot be any, you know, any kind of application requirements.
Okay. A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
On the other side of the coin, or on the other side of the chart, some of the schools are specifically for at-risk or learning impaired students. Do any districts ever recommend particular children to attend these schools?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, yes, they certainly can. They can, we have, especially the ones that are for at risk, we can have a counselor from a high school say, you know, a 21st century schoolhouse here in Salem-Keizer might be a really good fit for your child or, you know, to the student. However, if there's a waiting list, yeah, then, you know, they would go on that waiting list, or they cannot place them in there. Mm-hmm. Like in some alternative programs, a student in a high school or middle school can be placed into a program. Here it's a choice.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So Center for Advanced Learning, that is, like I said, it's quite a unique proposal. It's going to require some waivers from the state law to get it up and running, but I think that kind of speaks to the flexibility of the law. They are going to focus on information technology, medical, health, pre-engineering, hospitality, and tourism, and they will be opening in the fall of 2003. Then another very unique application that is in the works is Paisley. The charter school law allows for a one school district, so a K-12 that's all in one block, to become its own charter district. And so Paisley has applied for a planning grant, received a planning grant, and I believe they have their application in the works. Both Jim and I and Rob Kramer have been working with Paisley, with their community, with their school board, with their staff, so that because this is a first in the state also for a charter, to have a chartered district, not a school within a district, but the entire district be chartered. We have, is indicated in the next few pages, there's a variety of special focuses, and there's also a variety of grade configurations. We have some little K-12 charter schools, we have K-3, we have 6-12, so there's quite a bit of creativity with that. We have had one charter school that's been terminated. That's it was 2 years ago. It's in Malala River School District. We have two that have not been renewed. And one was not renewed because they just didn't have the number of students. By law, you have to have 25 students. And they were not able to come up with the number of students that they needed to operate. Another was not renewed. The charter was not renewed because they did not meet their goals. Charter schools are about accountability, and they did not meet their student achievement goals. We have three charter schools applications that have been submitted to the State Board of Education for sponsorship. Our law is unique, I think, from most of the other states in that just local districts can sponsor charter schools, and then if the application is denied by the local district, then the developers can appeal to the State Board for sponsorship. We do have one. The State Board, I think, just last Thursday, made a very, very thoughtful, deliberative decision to take the first step in State Board sponsorship, and that is that they resolved to approve the proposal. Then there's going to be a lot of other steps in negotiating the charter, and there's some other information that we're going to need to get from Portland Public. But that was I think, like Jim said, the law has kind of wound its way all the way, you know, almost to the bottom. We have two other applications that are at the State Board on appeal for State Board sponsorship. I guess one other note, the Senate Bill 124, which gives, the way the law is written now, once a charter school is denied by a local school district, the State Board then can either approve the application or deny. And this 124, it gives the State Board the authority to send the proposal back to the district and say, you know, we've worked with this application, and do you want to take another look at it? So that's, I guess, in the works.
Some of the things that we faced as challenges to date both in the issuance of Paisley, and we have other districts, by the way, that are looking at chartering their own schools. They may not be district-wide like Paisley is. By the way, Paisley, very small community, one school building that houses the entire thing. They really, truly see this as the way to save that school district. Because of the funding formula and their loss of kids, their revenue has dropped dramatically. There's a significant amount of federal money available, and when they went to the community and said, we may not be able to survive as a school district, they went to their largest employer in the little town there in Lake County, which is the U.S. Forest Service, and they said, if you close, we will move to Lakeview, which means essentially the death of that community, because that is the hub and center of the community, the school and the largest employer. They invited Joni and I to come down in the summer and do a presentation on charter schools, and the school was packed with community members. And this is a town that's agricultural based, and they had all the farmers and everybody in the community there. We had roughly about 150 people in the gymnasium at that school, and they've come together as a community, as a staff, to save that school district by creating a charter school. They faced a little bit of some difficulty, though, because our law has some uniqueness in it. One of the things we require is that you form a nonprofit corporation under Oregon's nonprofit corporation laws, and you be a 501c3. We did that because if people give items like cars, computers, and things to public schools, they get a tax deduction for that. If you gave it to a charter school, they don't get that unless they have the 501c3 status and the nonprofit corporation status in Oregon. So you have a district board, which is essentially going to put an application before itself. But yet they had to create a nonprofit corporation and also create this 501c3 with the Internal Revenue Service, which fortunately for them, we were able to get donated legal services and get that taken care of for them. But we will be introducing a bill that when districts want to start their own charter school, to eliminate that process so that the board, the mechanism's there already. You have the ability to get that tax deduction. It's an unnecessary step. I've talked to Rob Kramer at the Oregon Charter School Service Center, and he's in agreement on that. Everybody around has thus far agreed with that concept.
Excuse me, Representative Abakian.
Thank you. I want to make sure that I understand what you just said and give you a chance to be clearer if it needs to be clearer. But what I heard you say is that our inability or failure to ensure adequate funding for every district in this state has forced at least this one to look towards other options.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bakken, that's one part of it. You also have to remember that this is a very small school district, and when they lost, I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 students, that is a huge financial impact on that district. And they're a K-12 district, but in many of those classes, they only have 3 or 4 students. And when 12 students leave, you're not pulling them out of one grade. It's a couple of families that move away, and you're pulling them across the system, so you can't not have your third grade class any longer in Paisley. So in that instance, it is part of the funding issue that the state is currently under, because we're strapped in the general fund, and we take a lot of the general fund in K-12 schools. And in small school districts, when you lose kids, it's devastating to a program in a district. And they've done a lot of things. They've brought kids in from out of the United States. They've created a border school there, and they've tried everything they can, and they see this as one way to keep that community and that school alive.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yet, I would guess that your organization does support the notion that this body has an obligation to adequately support every district, regardless of its size.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abakian, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. I'm Dave Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the Paisley District discuss what they're going to do when the federal funding, the grant money, goes away?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hobson, yes, that was part of the community forum when we were down there, and they hope to try to amend some of the legislation that's in statute right now with regard to funding for small schools, that they believe that they're necessary. I haven't seen a proposal yet come out of that, because as you know, the federal funding is only there for 3 years, the initial 3 years of the charter school, and that's going to be really kind of the litmus test for a lot of charter schools. When that federal funding goes away, can you make it? And Paisley knows that that's a problem and that's an issue, but they're willing to at least take this opportunity to try to make it work and work for 3 years on finding some other options. They're forming foundations, contacting alumni. If you've ever been to Paisley, there's not very many businesses there, but they've all got jars on the counter saying, you know, save our schools. They They do just about anything they can in order to help out, try to get funding for that school and make it an ongoing entity. But they know it may be a short-term solution, but they want to at least try it to keep themselves in existence.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry we keep interrupting you. I know you have something to say. Why don't you, if it's okay, let's let her talk, and then I have one additional question.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Representative Farr was next. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
That's no problem.
Just very quickly, I'm assuming that Paisley, as a charter district, gets 100% of the funding stream, as opposed to giving that point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, that's correct. They're going to have to seek some waivers as well, because the state law talks about funding in that you get, in a K-8, 80% of the general purpose grant per ADMW, or 95% if it's a high school. Mm-hmm. They're going to need to perhaps seek a waiver. You can always go above, but it depends on the program that they ultimately come up with. And as we've said, their application is just kind of in its final stages going before the board. They will need to seek some waivers from the state board, because our law allows the state board to grant waivers for everything except in this document. There's a list in there, and we've called it the list of unwaivables for the really important stuff, the federal law, protection of kids, the health and safety of kids, fingerprinting of employees for criminal background purposes.
Yeah.
They will need to seek some of those, and they're going to do some unique things there in order to make the law work for them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bakken?
I was going to wait, and I think it's very important to say regard to this, and then maybe we can talk.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bakken, I also need to point out that the incentive grant, it obviously is a huge incentive to folks, because it's one of the only games in town that has some money. And it forces schools and districts to, to take a look at the extraordinary funding financial crisis that we're in is really forcing schools and districts to take a look at other opportunities. But the grant funds, there's two things that they cannot be used for. One, it's facilities, and the other one is just the operational, the ongoing expenses, because both the federal grant program and we at the department recognize that when those grant funds are gone, that is the critical time for charter schools. And so if you use them to pay just the ongoing second grade teacher salary, or the to pay for the renting the facility or whatever it is, that when those funds are gone, you're just not going to be able to operate. So in our grant application, and also I believe districts when they review charter applications, they really take a look at the sustainability of can the charter school make it when those federal monies are gone. In terms of Paisley, they have done an excellent job of using their grant funds at developing a curriculum. It's a vocational agricultural curriculum, and tying in with the Forest Service and doing some things that they've always wanted to do but haven't had any funds to do the professional development around these components, and aligning this new voc ag curriculum to the state standards. And I think that's really one of the kind of the spirit of the use of the grant funds.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Mr. Chair, since we're stopped for just a second here, I wanted to go back, Tony, and ask about the Center for Advanced Learning. Are they tying that into the CAM in any way? It sounded like it was very closely related.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, yes, absolutely. I think it's going to be a wonderful model of the CAM application.
Yes, Representative Bakken.
With regard to the Paisley example, which I thank you for bringing up, I think it's an excellent real and hypothetical example of how this model would work. If the 3 years goes by, the federal money is gone, and there's not additional state funding in order to further the support, then is the school left with a reliance on local government and private funding in order to continue operating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, are you talking in the instance of Paisley specifically, or charter schools in general?
I would guess both. You brought up the Paisley, but I think the question would apply to
both. Mr. Chairman, Representative Vakian, if in 3 years they don't have the funding, Paisley particularly, if they don't have the funding necessary to keep a sustainable school district, I haven't done my job for them. because that's one of my jobs here is to help advocate for more funds for them, and they also need to do some things as well. In the terms of a charter school, when a school district takes a look at an application, not like the Paisley process, one of the things you do, and Joni mentioned it, is that you look at the sustainability. You want to see a budget picture not only for that first year, but the second year and what they propose to do that third and fourth year. They would turn to, and most of the applications do contain, funding from foundations and private entities and fundraising, if you take a look at them. And one of the things the districts have done is to say to them, can you show us your business plan for that? How do you plan to do the fundraising to meet, you know, initially we were seeing $80,000 in fundraising. I've done enough fundraising for schools, my daughter's in school here in Salem Kaiser, that that's kind of unrealistic sometimes for small school populations. And one of the things that charter schools have been very aggressive about and very successful in is accessing foundation monies. The Walton Foundation has put a significant amount of money into them, as has the Gates Foundation, the Johnson Foundation. There's a list. Joni maintains a list of foundations, and I know Rob Kramer does from the Oregon Charter School Service Center, that they can apply to that will help them out. And a large chunk of money has come into the state of Oregon to charter schools through foundations.
Mr. Chair, this will be my last question.
That's fine. Go ahead.
What you're describing sounds to me like what you term to be a public school that within about a three-year period may become dependent on private resources for its survival.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, that may be true, but I know in my daughter's school choice, in the school she goes to, which is a public school here in Salem Kaiser, that may be where they're going to be in a couple of years, too, because we're funding things now as a parent when I was in school that was funded by the school district. And it's just an unfortunate circumstance that we find ourselves in the state. We're very reliant on the income tax, and we've had a very poor economy, as you well know. And that has driven down the general fund sources available to school districts, and it's having a real impact in classrooms. For independent charter schools, not the Paisley ones, they face probably even greater challenges, to be honest with you, in starting up. And the major one is finding a facility and paying for a facility. Those are very tough things for them to do because you can't use the grant money for that. And some school districts have allowed them to come into their facility if they have facility available, or in the case of the Dallas School District with PD Elementary or Philomath with the Kings Valley Charter School, they were going to close those little outlying elementary schools, and that community said, wait a second, that's our heart and soul, and the school district was willing to enter into an agreement with them, very low rent lease for the upkeep on the building. And that was a situation that worked out for those. But some charter schools simply can't get off the ground because of facilities and funding. And in this year's fiscal budget from the U.S. government, President Bush has proposed $200 million in his budget for charter school facility funding. We don't know if that's going to survive the process, but obviously a chunk of that would come to Oregon because we are one of 40 states that have charter schools, and then those folks would go out for a competitive grant. In the case of the Center for Advanced Learning, that unique one up in the East County, up in the metro area, two of those school districts actually passed bond levies to build the charter school building. Reynolds and I believe Gresham Barlow went to their voters and got bonds approved to build that charter school for kids not only from their districts, but the other two districts as well that are partners in that charter school. One of the other challenges that charter schools are seeing, and it's an issue that has been litigated, is the issue of PERS. Charter schools and their employees are required to be members of the public employee retirement system. And there have been some charter schools that haven't been making those payments, and those are issues of litigation that are currently pending. And I know Ms. Gillis can't comment about that because the litigation involves the Department of Education. But we will get a final answer to that and find out exactly what is meant. One of the issues is asking the State Board of Education to waive the PERS statute, a statute over which they don't have authority on. So the issue of the constitutionality of delegating the ability to waive a statute over which they don't have authority has come up, and we're going to find that out very soon. It's on its way to court right now. Teacher licensure, while it hasn't been a problem, it could potentially be because we're not seeing large numbers of licensed individuals come out of our schools of education and receive the continuing and initial licenses at TSBC. And I know Vicki Chamberlain spoke to this committee and talked about the issues at TSBC and the bill she's bringing. That will relieve some of the pressure at charter schools as well. But currently, there's a requirement in statute that 50% of the FTE, the full-time equivalency, of the staff at the charter school must have a license. That's not half the staff. It's half the FTE at the staff. And thus far, we're seeing upwards of 85 to 90% of the staff actually have teaching licenses. And the ones that don't, that are teaching, must register with TSPC. And that's an important piece of it because they have to undergo then that national criminal background check that would check to see if they've committed any crimes where they shouldn't be near our young children in our schools. So I know Ms. Chamberlain said that there was originally an issue with that, but the schools, the charter schools, are getting better as we move through this process. We're only into this in our fourth year now. So everybody had to learn as we went along, and especially the charter school folks, but they're becoming more proficient at a lot of things with regard to providing educational services to boys and girls. And I'll let Joni talk about accountability and the assessment piece that goes on in charter schools.
Okay. Mr. Chair, charter schools are about accountability, and charter schools are accountable on many fronts. Probably the first way they're accountable is in their charter. They sign they have an agreement between the charter school developers and the sponsoring school district and their goals that are set out in that charter. And the charter school needs to meet those goals. I talked a little bit earlier about one charter school that was not renewed because they did not meet the goals. Most of the goals, at least some of the goals have to do with student achievement. So you will see in a typical charter goal might be that the students' test scores will be as good or better than other test scores in the district, something like that. There are also other goals. There might be some non-academic goals in terms of student behavior, in terms of dropout, in terms of attendance. So they're accountable to their sponsor. There's an external accountability in that they're accountable. It's a school of choice, and so if parents and students choose to go to that school, so they're very accountable to their constituents, and if they say this is what we're going to do and this is what we're going to offer and they don't do it, then folks can walk with their feet and not attend. Another way that they're held accountable is through the No Child Left Behind. Charter schools, all the components of No Child Left Behind are also charter schools are also required to comply to those. So if a charter school receives Title I funding, then all the requirements of the highly qualified paraprofessionals, the highly qualified works teachers, all of those would need to comply with those. They need to comply with the AYP will also charter schools will also comply with AYP. Assessments, charter schools, I think Jim mentioned that charter schools, all content, one of the non-waivables in the law is the content standards and the Oregon State assessments. Charter schools, their students must take all the state assessments. And so when they're into their fourth year, they will all be getting report cards. I mean, they have report cards now, but there's a lot of not rated on each of the categories. So there's going to be accountability on many fronts with charter schools.
I've been asked, Mr. Chairman, a lot of times by school district boards, this movement's been around for about 12 years now, roughly, nationwide. Are they going away? And I think if you read the reports in the U.S. Department of Education at the 10-year, they're not going away. We're seeing more and more charter schools come along. And I believe that's a good thing, at least in Oregon, and that's due in large part to the way we crafted our law. We were very careful in the way we went about it, and we made them public schools. And one of the things that I know that's been on the forefront of the burners for some of the school districts, particularly if you take a look at the papers in some of our more major areas in the state, is a school board may want to consider a termination of accepting charter school applications. That provision is not allowed in law, at least in the current charter school law that we have before us. They'd like to place a moratorium on applications. And as I said earlier, it is a taxing process to, one, put together the application for the applicants, but also for the district in order to review the application. And one of the things that districts have attempted to do, not only in Oregon but across the nation, is to say we'd like a moratorium. Our law doesn't currently allow for that. If applications come in, they have to take a look at them. We do have a couple of caps, however, in the law. One sunsetted as of January 1 this year, which said that no more than 10% of your student population in your district could attend a charter school. That's sunsetted as of January 1. The other one that's in there is requirements on a population of a charter school, which is no more than 20% of your students in a charter school can come from a school outside of that district. And the reason that was put in was the fear of a raid on a small school district by another school district to get the ADMW, the average daily membership weighted of those kids coming in. That sunsets next January. And then, essentially, what we'll have is an open enrollment charter school across the state. We currently have that, except for that cap in there. You're probably all familiar with the inter-district transfer agreements that districts must now enter into. If my daughter wanted to attend Dallas, their regular school programs, both the Salem-Keizer Board and the Dallas School Board would have to agree to that. Under charter school law, that's outside of that process. If my daughter wants to attend that charter school in Dallas, so long as every Dallas kid has had the opportunity to attend that school and there's room available, my daughter may attend that school. And that's a little bit unique in Oregon because at first, a lot of districts thought, well, it's part of the inter-district transfer agreement. It's not. We have those caps in there, and those caps can be waived by the state board, and there have been requests for those, and they've been granted in a couple of instances. We talk about a school funding crisis here in the state. Some may argue about that. I believe it's real. But that's also going to drive some of the issues in charter schools. As funding gets tighter for school districts, you're going to pull more resources away from the classroom to review charter school applications. You're going to hear more grumbling probably out there in the field, both from applicants and school districts. And I don't have a solution to that. I have one solution, but I don't think we're going to see it come through this legislature this time. And I think it's going to take some time before we see a solution to the issue that we're talking about in our schools right now. The other is the incentive funding from the federal government. I think Representative Avakian and Representative Farr have talked about that a little bit. When it goes away in 3 years, what happens? We're going to find out, because right now we're up on that three-year mark in Oregon. The first schools that we chartered are coming up on not having federal funding any longer, and we're going to find out whether they can make it financially. And the ones that are out there that were originally chartered, I believe they're going to be able to make it when you look at their budgets and you look at their program and the dedication of the staff and the parents and the kids that are in that school. But it's going to be a challenge for them, and it's going to be something that is going to take some time for them to deal with, and they really need to do a lot of planning and working with their district on that. The main thing in a charter school that really works is a strong district policy to implement, the partnership with the applications, and the key, as I always tell every school board I talk to and every applicant that I talk to, is the document that creates your school, the charter or the contract, and I use those terms interchangeably, and it is a legal document. Whatever happens in that school is going to be bound by that agreement. And as I've said, some of the first ones I saw essentially were written on the back of a cocktail napkin. As you can imagine, issues came up in that charter school that were not addressed by that. And we've since learned some things in the state, and each time I write one, I learn something else from something that had gone on in another charter school. And I think now we're probably getting down to where we've got this down pretty good. But it is very key that those be good documents and that they be reviewed by legal counsel, because if something happens, you have to fall back on that document. And it is a legal negotiation of a contract. Sometimes those can be very protracted. Sometimes they can be somewhat ugly in what a charter school may want and a district not willing to give up, and vice versa. But those are very key in being able to create a good program for boys and girls. And then also, as Joni and I said, we've had formed very good partnerships. I believe of statewide associations of school boards, we're the only one in the nation that supports the charter school law. And we work very closely with the department and charter school applicants and charter school service center to make these successful public schools. When we saw the law and it's a public school, then we want to make sure that our boards are willing to work with them and make sure that they're going to create good programs for boys and girls, because they are public schools, they will spend public tax dollars, they are held accountable, and the board that ultimately sponsors them need to be held accountable as well.
Mr. Chair, go along with what Jim is saying, and this came as a commendation, actually, with the evaluation that the Northwest Regional Lab did on our charter school program, is the rigor of our charter application process. And we work with the applicants and with the school districts to say that the school boards have a responsibility to ask tough questions, because Jim and I like to say this is about the two most precious resources, and it's children and it's money, and we hope it's in that order. And so a school district board has responsibility to ask tough but fair questions, and the charter school folks have a responsibility to be able to answer those tough but fair questions, because in many cases, if they can't answer them, they might not be prepared to, you know, to operate the school. So I think that, and that was, like I said, a commendation in the evaluation that we received, that we do have a rigorous process. It's not easy. However, I think it will result in the quality of educational opportunities that we want for our children.
And finally, to wrap up, I think we'll skip a couple of things in the evaluation process. You can read the criteria that a school district has to use in reviewing, and I think we've hammered home that it's a pretty rigorous process. And it's a very rigorous process for a school district when they review it, whether they're going to deny or they're going to approve one. But let's talk about the funding real quickly, and I'm starting on page 12. As you can well imagine, the most important thing about funding is, or in charter schools, is funding. It takes up 9 pages of our handouts here, and I'm not going to walk you through all 9, but I'll give you the scenario. And if you'll use this diagram, this is probably the best visual explanation of how charter school funding works. Behind it, I've given you some information particular to the Siusala School District in Lane County. That's the Florence area. And the reason I gave you that is that's one of the last school districts I went out to talk to them about charter schools. And, of course, one of the questions I always get from the boards is, what's the funding scenario look like? So I've given you an outline of their funding under the law, and then I've given you 2 pages of documents from the State Department of Education's database initiative webpage. These are what we call the district run. You'll see district runs from legislative revenue, but these are their updates on funding and how much money they have or do not have. I've given you 2 because there was one update done in October, and then there was one done yesterday from the State Department because of the failure of ballot measure 28. And if you look at the bottom on page 20 of that one, you'll see down underneath the box that says State School Fund Grant for 02-03 for the Siusala School District. At that time in October, that when the State Department of Education sent this out, they assumed passage of ballot measure 28. And you'll note that the amount down there, it says General Purpose Grant SB-100 in print right in the middle at the bottom of the page is $4,816. That's the amount that charter schools would get. It's the general purpose grant per ADMW of the school district. Essentially what it is, total formula revenue minus the transportation grant, because charter schools don't have the transportation mandate, divided by the ADMW of the school district, you get that number. K-8 in a charter school minimally get 80% of that number, and for a high school it's 95% of that number. High schools generally cost more to run, and you can see from the chart that the Department of Education, that graphic I showed you, how the money flows. A little bit of a unique thing, when the student isn't a resident of the district, in the case I told you about my daughter wanted to enroll in a Dallas one, for instance, in that instance, we have a little bit of a quirk in our law, and it caused some problems originally, but it makes some sense if you think about it. If she wanted to attend fourth grade out in Dallas, she would become a Dallas student for purposes of the state school fund dollars. So her ADMW transfers from Salem-Keizer to Dallas. Dallas makes the count to the Department of Education. She enrolls in the charter school. Dallas passes through minimally to their charter school 80% of whatever their figure is through these runs. And they keep 20%, essentially. Of that 20%, they have to send half back to the Salem-Keizer School District, which has created a nightmare for our business managers, because all of a sudden they've got money coming in and going out, but there's a chart of accounts for it at the Department of Ed. The reason that that was put in is twofold. One, if something should happen to that charter school, it shuts down, or health and safety of the kids are at risk, and they're shut down permanently on that basis, my daughter has the right to come back to Salem-Keizer and attend public school. That recognizes that issue for Salem-Keizer. Also, because 3 students leave Salem-Keizer, that does not mean that the ongoing cost of providing educational services to all the rest of the kids have gone down. They're still going to run the same number of buses, same number of teachers, have the same number of buildings. That helped to recognize that cost. That situation's the same if the state board's the sponsor. So in the instance of the one up in Portland Public, the Victory Middle School, the money will flow to Portland Public. Portland Public will pass it through to the charter school, even though they denied that charter school under the contract that the state board will enter into with them, and Portland must then send back, actually it probably won't be a send back, it'll be done electronically through the state school fund payments, half of that to the State Department of Education. Reason? There is cost associated with sponsoring and monitoring that charter school to make sure they're meeting their requirements in their contract. Mm-hmm. Now, for special ed kids, it throws a whole nother kink into it. And the reason is, and we think we're pretty smart in doing this now. We went to a national conference, a bunch of us here from Oregon, and our mantra back there was, we're not you, we're Oregon. Because in some instances with charter school laws in other states, they made the charter school, the local education agency, the LEA, which then has responsibility for special education, and it has created havoc in some charter schools. What we said is, whatever resident district the student comes from, that's the district that has responsibility for special education services, the way it is with every other public school student in the state. So for purposes of that, if the student goes to a district outside of their resident district and attends that charter school, the resident district and that charter school negotiate a payment of 40% of the double weight, which is for a K-8, which is an 80% of the single weight, and 47.5% for a high school of the double weight, because that equals 95%. The rest of the money, if you look at charter school law and what was being reasoned at the time, is for the special education services, which are going to be provided and the responsibility of the resident district.
Mr.
They
Chair.
Can contract with that charter school or whoever they want to provide it, but the simple logic is they've been dealing with the student on an IEP, the liability's there, plus many of the districts don't want to assume that liability for a student that they don't have the control over for their educational program.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. I think you may have answered my question with that last statement. In that the resident district is assuming the responsibility for the IED, did I hear you say that they can contract with the charter school and therefore some of that $5,500 would flow to the charter school for the IED?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, yes, that's absolutely right. The responsibility remains with the resident district. However, with some charter schools, if they might have a special ed teacher on staff, mm-hmm. then the resident district would contract with the charter school. They might keep some of the funds out for doing the district kind of paperwork, but then some of the money would flow to the charter school. And that's really, it's kind of a case-by-case, student-by-student basis, and then that's included in the charter.
So that $5,500 is a somewhat liquid fund that can go to an agency or to the charter school or to whomever is going to be providing the bulk of the education or the specialized program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, yes.
Thank you.
And I think that concludes the presentation. It's probably more information than you wanted on charter schools, Mr. Chairman, but we have a very active law. If you take a look at the website for the Center for Educational Reform, which generally is not a positive website on public schools, however, it ranks charter school laws across the nation. And we received a B there. And a B for them means it's an active state law. And we do have a very active state law, I can assure you of that. Not only is my time divided between FERS committee, I have six districts that want me to come out and help them review applications currently as well. And I think Joni, for the first time, actually had to make the federal grants a competitive grant process, truly competitive, so that some of the folks that wanted some of those federal dollars aren't going to get them through their grant process. We're seeing a lot more interest in it. We're seeing a lot of school districts take interest in it as a way to save program and also to address the No Child Left Behind, having alternative learning avenues for kids to use. There have been problems with the charter school law. I'm not here to say that it's all going smoothly, but we've worked through those issues with the legislature and the State Department of Education, and we formed a partnership with the applicant groups, the school boards, and the department to try to make this work for kids. And I appreciate you having us here. And Joni has any final comments?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for being here. As Jim said, it is a very active law. We have it on, it's housed in the Office of Curriculum Instruction Field Services, and there's myself and three other staff members that are always visiting districts, working with applicants, answering questions, and active would be a good description. So thank you very much for having us here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Sorry to dominate the question.
No, that's fine.
I'm assuming then, we had the presentation on the report card. I'm assuming that charter schools have all the same requirements and all the same reporting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, that's correct. As a matter of fact, they have their own individual report card just like every other school, and they also become part of the composite of the school district. However, when you go to look, you probably won't see that they have a rating because you have to have baseline data for so many years. Some of these are very new. It's probably more important for you with the charter schools to look at the test scores for the kids because most of the accountability pieces go to that. But also remember, some of these charter schools are addressing some of our hardest children to educate, at-risk populations. And maybe their accountability plan is that this kid is in school and actually learning and just coming to school on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they even have a test score to be reported on that student is success for that student.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Nice to see you again. And we do appreciate the information. And if there's too much, Jim, we always can look it up.
Thank you.
Hannah Herlin.
Thank you.
That was good.
Yeah. We have a couple of volunteer presenters, and you heard, committee, much reference to Rob Kramer and his group, and Rob Kramer is here. So, Rob, if you'd like to come up, that's great. We also have Mr. Ed Johnston, who is from Lincoln County, who would like to present briefly, too. Rob, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Kramer, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Public Charter School Service Center, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. One of the things that I do with regards to my role at the Charter School Service Center is I have the opportunity to help people start new public charter schools. We typically will get involved with a new project from the start, not always, but typically, when a group of teachers, a group of parents, community members come to us and say, will you help us start a charter school in our community? That is some of the most rewarding work that I can imagine. Helping teachers achieve a professional vision of their own in the form of their own public school. Helping community members fill a need that they know exists in their public school. And the shepherding we do, the advocacy work that we do, helping this vision become a reality in their community is very, very rewarding. I'd like to talk about just one project and give you a sense of the type of thing that we do, the types of schools that are being created. There's a school called the Four Rivers Charter School Project in Ontario, Oregon. Two teachers who are elementary school teachers, one named Jose Melendez and one named Shell Giebert, developed a model in their school district, and this is a school district which has 37% of its student population is non-English speaking, mostly Hispanic. They developed a model in their district in which they taught half the time in Spanish and half the time in English for all of the kids, both the Hispanic kids and the English-speaking kids. This, for 2 years, this model was very successful. They had a long waiting list of parents who wanted in, and Shell and Jose decided that they would create a charter school based on this same concept. And this strikes home for Jose, who was an immigrant, came to Oregon when he was 19 years old, spoke no English at all, had no money, spent years in the fields until he accumulated enough money to go to community college, get his GED, and then went to college and got his teaching certificate, and then for 20 years has taught in the public schools in Ontario. And now he has a chance to take something he knows how to do, teach Hispanic kids and English kids the other language, and show the kids that there is opportunity in the United States and show them how to access it. And to have Jose and Shell use the public charter school law to create a school that will do this in their community is tremendously rewarding work, and I call myself fortunate to be able to help them. I'd like to also compliment the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon School Board Association. Jim Green said that we are considered somewhat unique around the United States because of the relationship that the charter advocates, the department, and the School Board Association have forged over the term of the time we've had our charter school on effect. It is unique, and in fact, I'll say this. If I had $1 million for every time another person in charter school work across the nation said, I wish I had your OSBA, if I had $1 million for that, I could probably fund the PERS liability in Oregon. Maybe not quite. But I really do appreciate the hard work that Jim Green, the Oregon School Board Association, and Joni and the Department of Ed have done in implementing the Oregon Charter School Law in good faith. And we have 23 active schools now to show for it, and I expect to have at least a half a dozen more opening this coming fall. I also have been it's very rewarding to see the charter school law used in communities around the state to save public schools from closure, which has now happened 4 times. small rural community schools that were at threat of closure because of fiscal realities in school districts who were looking at these small schools and seeing that they're just not cost effective to keep open, and having school boards and school districts work hand in hand with a community who the last thing they want to have happen is close their community school, and to have the charter school law be used as a vehicle to save these schools in a collaborative effort across the board is very rewarding. And now, according to Jim, there's an entire community that's going to be saved, Paisley, because of the charter school law. Back in 1999, when we passed this law, I never envisioned that this would happen as a result of it, but it's rewarding to see that it has. Joni and Jim described the charter school arena here in Oregon as very active, and I would agree. I would say it's vigorous and robust. There is an immense amount of attention and effort being put into starting new schools all over the state, and I think we're going to see more and more of them. I'd like to briefly talk about a couple of things that I heard addressed. Representative Ivaki, and you had some questions about the long-term sustainability, financial sustainability of charter schools after the federal dollars run out, and that is an issue. The assessment of a charter proposal should take that into account. That is, ask the question, once those dollars run out, will the charter school be able to survive on the per student amount that comes through the funding formula? And we, I think, have done a pretty good job in collaboration with the OSBA and with the Oregon Department of Education, making sure that only those charter school projects that have that kind of long-term fiscal sustainability are going to be approved on the front end. And that is probably the best check on whether those schools, after the federal dollars run out, are going to be able to survive.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ivaki,
just in case you'd like to comment further on it, the intent of my question wasn't so much to the economic survival of the school, but that once it is weaned off of public money and gets higher percentages of private money, what does that do to the public nature of the entity? And doesn't it then become more private in nature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ivaki, I don't believe so, and I'm not sure that I buy the assumption that that will result in a higher percentage of their total budget coming from quote-unquote private sources. I think that what we'll see is the federal dollars kind of fill a short-term gap in their fiscal picture to pay for the startup expenses involved with perhaps remodeling some facilities for ADA compliance and for code, also for buying the hard goods like curriculum and desks and all the furniture that you need to start a new school. And those are one-time costs. And most projects that we're involved with, I should say all projects that we're involved with, once those one-time costs are paid for, the school is able to sustain itself on the per student amount with a small percentage of its money coming from outside fundraising. And I would say that no larger a percentage comes from outside fundraising than a lot of public schools or district operated public schools that have school foundations or other types of fundraising that they use. And I don't think that that's a risk. Our district schools are at risk of becoming non-public schools. I'd like to talk a little bit about some legislation that I hope will be in front of this committee this time. I hope non-controversial technical adjustments to the charter bill. Jim Green mentioned the bill that the OSBA would have regarding Paisley School District and the changing some rules by which school districts might sponsor their only public school to become a charter school. We'll be supporting that legislation and helping it go through. I think that is a good idea. I also think we need to address a couple of things. Number one, the audit requirement for charter schools. Currently, they're required to have a municipal audit, but charter schools are not municipal entities. They are private nonprofit entities. We fully support fiscal accountability for charter schools, and we want charter schools to have an annual audit, but that should be a financial audit, not a municipal audit. And so we'll have some legislation that will change the wording in the statute saying charter schools must have a fiscal or financial audit, and repealing the language that requires a municipal audit. Also, the PERS issue is a big one. And obviously, PERS is going to be dealt with in many ways in this legislative session, in this committee, and in others. As it stands now, charter schools can get a waiver from PERS if their sponsor, a school district, goes hand in hand with the charter school and requests a waiver to the state from the PERS requirement. And so if there's a good relationship between the charter and the sponsor, and the sponsor agrees to ask for that waiver, there's no reason they can't get that waiver from PERS. and that was according to an attorney general's opinion that was passed down almost a year ago now. Now, it seems to me that we should talk about whether charter schools should be able to opt out of PERS entirely if their employees don't want it. We had one situation in a charter school in Portland where every single employee signed on the dotted line saying, no, we do not want PERS because we would like that money allocated towards our health plan. And the state was forced to not approve that. The state said, no, I'm sorry, unless the sponsor agrees to request this waiver, we cannot go along. And the sponsor in this case was not in agreement.
Yeah. Representative Scott.
In reference to that, and in the comments that Mr. Green made in to the number of delinquencies, is it fair to assume that they are delinquent to the form that the other supporting districts are not willing to let them opt out, or is it just simply financial that they're not paying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, are you saying the charter schools that are delinquent in their PERS payments?
Yes.
To my knowledge, there are only two of those, one of which is had their charter not renewed by Portland School District, and so it's not really an issue now. The other is still pending, and that's a litigation pending. I think every other charter school is fully complying with the PERS law and paying into PERS, that to my knowledge. The final small issue I think we might want to deal with is the occasional foot dragging we are seeing from certain school districts around the state. When a charter school is proposed in a district has 3 weeks in order to communicate back to the charter school whether or not their proposal was complete. When they get word that it is complete, there's a 60-day window to have a public hearing and then a 30-day window to approve or deny that charter. And then if the answer is no, there's an ability for appeal, and I'm sure you're familiar with the process. We're seeing some foot dragging on that first 15-day window or 15 business day window in which school districts are saying, sorry, your application is not complete, and when actually it was. And they're using this as a way to delay the project long enough so it's impossible for that school to open up in the next school year. And if we think about this, the windows are not very wide. If a school district has a November 15th deadline, and you submit on that deadline, and let's say the approval was, or the proposal was judged complete at that time, we have 2 months to have a hearing, another month to approve or deny, and if denied and appealed to the state, then there's a long process of mediation and possible appeal asking for the decision from the state. Pretty quickly you get into the June-July area of the following summer, which makes it virtually impossible to, even if approved, then open up that fall. And I think we need to take a look at some of these timelines to see if there are ways we can't compress them a little bit in order to make it actually realistic for a school to get through a process from November 15th and open their school in the fall on their schedule.
Excuse me, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, help me with the proposal is given to the school board for the determination, and they have 15 days. Don't the majority of the school boards only meet once a month, and so that could, in fact, be a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I don't believe that the judgment of whether or not the proposal is complete needs to be an action of the school board.
You answered my question better than I worded it.
So there, I hope we can address this the timeline question in some legislation that moves through this session as well. And with that, I would be happy and pleased to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you. Bob, how many denials have there been? What's the ratio of granting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I don't have that specific information. I would guess it's in the 1 in 4 denied.
Okay.
And that's just a rough estimate. We're finding that the majority of school districts are dealing very fairly with charter schools, and I've been very pleased. And I think that, again, is a result of the posture that the Oregon School Boards Association has taken with regards to the statute. I think we can say because they've shown the leadership and the fair and honest and good faith implementation of the charter law, we're seeing school districts around the state also go along.
Rob, would it be fair to say then that Oregon has one of the more outstanding charter school laws in America?
Mr. Chair, I would say it's a very good law. Yeah, there are some problems with it, like there are in any structure of a law that you might suggest. I would say that Oregon's might be a little more difficult than other states to start a charter school, but I would also say that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we want it to be a rigorous and a vigorous process of starting. I think we want there to be some pushback from the school district or the sponsor saying, no, you haven't dealt with this clearly enough. You haven't thought this part through. Your budget may be deficient in certain respects. I would agree with the Center for Education Reform's grading of our law as a strong, in their category of strong laws, and in the B to B plus category.
Committee, if I'm recalling correctly, of course, our law was passed in 1999, and I believe there was about 100 amendments before it was finally completed. I'm an old statistical person because I was a baseball coach, and I think that's the second highest number of amendments in Oregon history, so I was told. And so that law, that bill was worked and worked and reworked and changed and amended, and so what came out was well done.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to agree. The process was lengthy, and Representative Hobson, I know you were there for every step of the way, as was I, but I think the sausage we created tastes just fine.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you.
And we're running out of time, but as we began the meeting, we had a note here. Mr. Ed Johnston would like to speak, and so, Ed, please come up.
Yeah, thank you. Please forgive me if I get a little off a little bit in my little structure pain. My neck's been broken twice, so I deal with things as best as I can. My name's Ed Johnston. I'm from Toledo, Oregon, Lincoln County. I'm the one who started and completely worked with the Oregon State Employees Association to make sure that we did recall each and every school board member. And I'm not here representing the union or anybody else but myself and why this was started, so people know the true reasons compared to misconceptions that have been led. The one thing is dealing with our superintendent. We want to get rid of him. We think that dealing with that, there ought to be a law that the citizens should be able to either vote out or at least get enough petitions to get a superintendent out of school. With our present school board, we're still working with that over budgets. We have gone through the budget. I have put in pages of documents to the Secretary of State, State Attorney Generals for an audit on our school district. Roughly $25 million are questionable. We'd like to know where that money went to. And all from our district attorneys, the State Attorney General's office has stated that if our Attorney General or our district attorney would write a letter and state that we should have an investigation, that the State Attorney General's office would pay for it all. And I have that letter, and I've given that to several senators, state reps here. And what really disturbs me is we're not getting any reaction to it. We're basically following what we feel is like the good old boy network. Let's cover it up because of, and I can sort of understand to a degree, and I don't want to say good old boy network, I can sort of understand. If we do open a hornet's nest, how far would that react to at the state or anything else? So we need to come up with solutions. And dealing with our superintendent's positions and our pay, we're paying our superintendent $180,000 with benefit back. So that's in Lincoln County. That's part of the reason why we threw out our school board. And with our administration, we feel we're overpaying them. We feel we...
Yeah. Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to state for the record, I'm a little uncomfortable with some of this conversation, and that the other side of the story, if you will, certainly isn't here.
I respectfully understand that, but even when we were doing the recall, the media would not allow us any coverage of the opposition of going through with the recall, and Lincoln County residents did overwhelmingly recall the school board.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Lockheed.
I would echo the concern, not appreciating the position you're in, that may not be a sounding board for media access in order to get a certain opinion out, and that if there is a critical issue that should be before us, maybe proper notice be given so that all parties have the availability.
True. That's very fine. I like to bring in some hand into evidence, too. The one suggestion, like PERS, is one of our concerns in medical benefits. Why don't we take the government employees and put them in the Oregon Health Plan, bail it out? Just in our district alone, we spend $5.2 million just to medical for a school district. Combined, it's roughly $13 to $20 million with our city county. just in Lincoln County of 50,000 people. There are solutions that we can't come up with our PERS problem. Do it on a 401k plan, 8-to-8 match. There are solutions we can come to save our schools. If I'm not advocating, I'm one of those that pulled out our kids to homeschool because of what's going on in our schools, because of school surveys, intrusion with the Department of Federal Human Resources, finally determined that the Saturn program was federally illegal. You know, and that's been out. And I'm the one who pushed for that, to make sure that truth, when I was on a local school committee 6 years ago, to make sure that reality came out with the school surveys were actually doing to the students and the families of our state. So when it comes down to protecting our families and students, I believe that we need to save our public schools to a degree, work with them, but also to come up with solutions so we're not invading the families, making sure that our schools are working with us, not against us. The one thing I have to say dealing with, like, Eddyville Charter School, we are trying to get the charter school going on in Eddyville. We're having opposition a little bit with our superintendent. That is another thing that is extremely frustrating. I feel, and a lot of other people feel, that the superintendent's position of law should be changed of their education standards, because after so many doctorates or whatever, that's when you become a superintendent. Maybe we ought to appoint a business manager or something to that position, because the superintendent, we need somebody that's going to run a school in a business manner, not run a superintendent's position where they're overthrowing what the community is trying to say. We don't want to privatize our school district. That's what they're trying to do to us. We do not want that in our school district. We have made that quite clear, especially with the recall. The one thing I want to say with at-risk disability kids, that was the other thing with...
Oh, excuse me, and yeah. Representative Ivan.
Yes, sir.
It looked like you had some written materials. Did you have some materials that you had brought to leave with us?
Yes, I do, and I will do that more
fairly.
Are you
interested in being able to take the materials and have a chance to read and digest mm-hmm. them later?
No, I respectfully do that, so I'll make it quick, because I believe everybody else would like to get on with their day, too. But I think there are some solutions to problems, and we need to be realistic, even though some opposition might not like it, but we have to balance both sides out to be equal, and we have to look at down the future that in 20 years are we going to put our kids or grandkids in a 75% tax bracket. In reality, that's what we're really looking forward and coming into. If we don't stop PERS and other things right now, we have to be honest, not only with ourselves, but what are we going to do to our kids and our grandkids?
Ed, you may know this, but we do have a PERS committee that works exclusively on PERS issues, and so I think there have been 15 bills now that have been written, and there are a lot more. So that'll be an issue that's ongoing through.
Well, no, I understand it. Yeah. I would like to hopefully be here next Tuesday if things work out, because I mean, I'm not here paid by anybody. I'm just a citizen. Right now, I don't have. I get by people that help. Basically donate money to get me up here, because I'm fighting state disability, workman's comp, because I fall through the cracks of our lovely system. And so I'm right now in the position of being forced almost to sell my house and lose everything because of our system. So it's one of those things that just gets a little frustrating. Mm-hmm. So, but we can't come up with a reasonable solutions to come up with ways instead of looking too far behind us. We got to look for the future, what the best economic reasons are going to be. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for coming up. Yeah. With that, we will adjourn today's meeting. Have a good weekend.